On RT Radio 1 now, Arts Tonight, presented by Vincent Woods.
On the programme, remembering Africa's great writer Chinua Achebe.
Then everything had been broken. He had been cast out of his clan, like a fish onto a dry, sandy beach, panting.
And the beat of rebellion, African music of protest and politics.
Free, 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 Nelson Mandela!
Hello and welcome to Arts Tonight. Here in Ireland, we have a long tradition of song and music as political statement, ballads as sedition and rebellion, music as defiance, song as a repository of unofficial history. Something similar has long been the case in many parts of Africa. And later in the programme, we'll be looking at and listening to some of the music that was at the heart of rebellion in South Africa and in the Congo. But first, a writer whose stature and enduring legacy makes him the literary equivalent of the late Nelson Mandela. And Mandela himself described Chinua Achebe as a writer in whose presence the prison walls came down. Achebe is widely regarded as the father of modern African literature, and his death last year foreshadowed Mandela's passing, two of the most significant figures of modern Africa laid to rest within months of each other. Achebe's novel Things Fall Apart, first published in 1958, is the best known and most widely read novel of Africa, an acute and original work which describes traditional village life and its falling apart. Other novels like No Longer at Ease, Arrow of God and A Man of the People trace the effects of Christianity and colonialism on African societies and the bitter turn of military rule in an unnamed country. His non-fiction writings, including There Was a Country, his account of the Biafran War, are vivid and enduring works of criticism and witness. Barack Obama described Achebe as a writer who shattered the conventions of literature and shaped the collective identity of Nigerians throughout the world. With me to look at Chinua Achebe's work, in particular the novel Things Fall Apart, are Amike Chukwuru, who spoke at a memorial service for the writer in Dublin last year, and Dr. Melanie Otto, lecturer in English at Trinity College Dublin. But first, let's hear the author himself, Chinua Achebe, reading from Things Fall Apart.
Okonkwo and his family worked very hard to plant a new farm. But it was like beginning life anew without the vigor and enthusiasm of youth, like learning to become left-handed in old age. Work no longer had for him the pleasure it used to have. And when there was no work to do, he sat in a silent half-sleep. His life had been ruled by a great passion to become one of the lords of the clan. That had been his life spring, and he had all but achieved it. Then everything had been broken. He had been cast out of his clan, like a fish onto a dry, sandy beach, panting. Clearly, his personal god, Ochi, was not made for great things. A man could not rise beyond the destiny of his chi. The saying of the elders was not true, that if a man said yea, his chi also affirmed. Here was a man who said yes. Here was a man whose chi had said no, despite his own affirmation. The old man, Uchendo, saw clearly that Okonkwo had yielded to despair, and he was greatly troubled. He would speak with him after the Isaifi ceremony. On the second day, Uchendo called together his sons and daughters and his nephew, Okonkwo. The men brought their goatskin mats with which they sat on the floor. And the women sat on a sisal mat spread on a raised bank of earth. Uchendu pulled gently at his gray beard and gnashed his teeth. Then he began to speak, quietly and deliberately, picking his words with great care.
Chinua Achebe there, reading from his novel Things Fall Apart. Well, with me to look at Chinua Achebe's work, in particular the novel Things Fall Apart, are Emeka Chigurh, who spoke at a memorial service for the writer in Dublin last year, and Dr. Melanie Otto, lecturer in English at Trinity College Dublin. Melanie Otto, that novel, first published in 1958, just 2 years before Nigerian independence. What was its significance then? You know, what impact did it have, and what has made it the most widely read book in Africa?
Well, Things Fall Apart, the project of Things Fall Apart, really is setting the record straight. It writes against the misrepresentation of Africa in European literature, in Heart of Darkness, for example, by Joseph Conrad, and more specifically Mr. Johnson by Joyce Carey. And it presents the process by which Africa was silenced and written over by Europe, if you want. And if you look at the setup of Things Fall Apart, it has three parts. And the first part, you have, if you want, Africa speaking without the interruption of Europe. At least that's the illusion we get. Then in the second part, you have the beginning conflict between Africa and Europe. And in the third part, you have Africa being silenced. And I think that's also epitomised in the death of Okonkwo at the end.
You mentioned you mentioned the novel Mr. Johnson there by Joyce Carey. He, of course, was from Derry. So there are these two links to Ireland in the book, the title coming from Yeats, and then Achebe writing against what he perceived as a kind of condescension and simplification of African life in that novel.
Yeah, that's he had a real issue with Mr. Johnson as a student, and in one of his essays he writes about his student years, and also his fellow students had the very same feeling, and he said that was a kind of a central moment in African awareness of how they are depicted in European literature, and he links it to kind of developing a national consciousness and a consciousness of, you know, decolonization as well. It's a kind of a, because he says when he was growing up and he was reading English literature, he identified with a white hero. And in a sense, that is an experience that a lot of people from the now post-colonial world had. Frantz Fanon, for example, from Martinique, he had the same experience. And so the black characters weren't the characters they identified with. They identified with the white characters. And obviously, that led to a kind of a sense of being estranged from your own culture, from your own people, if you want.
Emeka Chukwuru, what has Achebe meant to you? And in particular, again, what does the novel Things Fall Apart mean to you and to a younger generation of Nigerians?
Incidentally, Achebe is a novelist you discover. I mean, it would be interesting to think that in Nigeria he has such an impact with the younger generation. But it's not really the case. I mean, Achebe talks about reading books like Gulliver's Travel when he was growing up, another Irish connection. And most of us growing up in Nigeria actually aspire to the Western ideal. So we don't actually read Achebe when we're young. We discover him, like, you know, most Europeans do. And when you do, I think it's when you're questioning about, you know, identity, you know, what's the place of an African in the world. And you discover him, and that's such a huge resonance in his work. And I think once people discover that, like, you know, Chimamanda Adichie, like she said, it gives you permission to be African, to express yourself and not be, you know, ashamed that you're black or you're African or your history is inferior by any chance. So that's actually one of the, you know, interesting things. We are not exposed to him when we're young, but we discover him and, you know, it hits such a significant resonance.
Igbo culture and language essential to Achebe right throughout his life, even after he moved to the US and where he lived for the last 28 years or so, for the most part of his life. And Igbo proverbs informing so much of the way he wrote and giving his writing this extraordinary power and originality.
Yeah, I use an illustration. My wife is Igbo parentage, but she was born in Ireland, and she learnt Igbo almost as a foreigner back home. And in the school exam, she had an A because she could associate with it, you know. I didn't make an A, and for the simple reason that I didn't use proverbs. In oral speech in Igbo, proverbs are it. You know, you can write the most beautiful in Igbo, but if you cannot use the obliqueness that we use in communicating, Igbos don't ever say anything direct. It's always, you know, it goes in circles.
But a beautiful circle.
Exactly. But at the end of the day, you know, if you understand the meaning, it hits at a much deeper level than, you know, any direct speech, can make.
The Nigerian writer Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie is one of a generation of young novelists influenced by Achebe. She took part in a pen celebration of his work to mark the 50th anniversary of the publication of Things Fall Apart.
I'd like to share a few personal stories about Things Fall Apart. I grew up in Nsukka on the campus of the University of Nigeria. I grew up the daughter of people who worked in the university. My father was a professor. My mother was an administrator. I was an early reader. My mother says that I started to read when I was 2, although I think 4 is probably closer to the truth. And when I started to read, I was reading mostly British children's books, in which all the characters were white and ate apples and played in the snow and had dogs called Socks. I was also an early writer, and I wrote little stories and exercise books with illustrations that I colored with crayons. And I was writing exactly the stories that I was reading. And so all my characters were white and blue-eyed and played in the snow and ate apples and had dogs called Socks. This, despite the fact that I lived in a town in eastern Nigeria where it rained rather than snowed, and where I ate mangoes and cashews rather than apples. But I didn't know that people like me could exist in books. I had assumed that books, by their very nature, had to have English people in them. And then I read Things Fall Apart. For me, it was a glorious shock of discovery. Here was a book with characters who had familiar names, Okonkwo, Ezimma. Here was a book that had expressions that I found familiar, although mostly written in English, and I knew the Igbo versions. And so when I came across, when a man says yes, his chi says yes also, I knew the Igbo, which is onyepwe chiyepwe. I grew up bilingual, speaking Igbo and English at the same time, often speaking Igbo and English in the same sentence. And here was a book whose aesthetics so accurately captured my bilingual world. And yet, despite the familiarity of Things Fall Apart, it was also incredibly exotic. These characters did not have cars or telephones, things that I took for granted in my life. And I was also horrified that they had fufu for breakfast. I considered fufu too heavy and inappropriate for breakfast. Only years later, looking back, did I realize what a huge mental shift the discovery of Things Fall Apart was for me. It didn't happen overnight, but slowly I stopped writing about the England I did not know at all, and I started to write about the small slice of Nigeria that I did know. I would return to Things Fall Apart often over the years. I was educated in a system that taught me nothing of my pre-colonial past, and so Things Fall Apart became strangely personal. It became the life that my great-grandfather had lived. And later, when I read other books about Africa, books in which I was told that we had no history, accounts of Africa as a place of anarchic darkness until colonialism came, accounts in which Africa was defined by negatives, by what it was not and by what it did not have, accounts in which I was told how Africa was dying and I was never told how Africa lived, I would also turn to Things Fall Apart. I would feel almost overwhelmed by that peculiarly African feeling of vulnerability and defensiveness that comes with having to somehow prove your humanity to others. And so turning to Things Fall Apart, when I wanted to reach in and smack Okonkwo when he beat his wife, when I identified with the wonderful, brilliant, fierce Ezimma, when I felt a deep affection for the gentle flute-playing Unoka, when I felt great delight at the tiny love story of Ozemina and Ndulue, when I read the many beautiful proverbs, when I encountered the stark, sheer poetry of Things Fall Apart, it would serve as a gentle reprimand for me. What it said to me was, don't you dare think that you did not have a complex past. And I know I'm not the only one for whom Things Fall Apart is personal. I have often heard many Nigerians argue quite fiercely about whether Okonkwo really should have killed Ikemefuna and whether or not Wuye was a good son. What has always struck me, however, is how Okonkwo and Wuye and Ikemefuna are spoken about as though they're real. And indeed, they were real. I think Chinua Achebe has created characters who are real because they're vibrantly alive in our imaginations.
I remember seeing Achebe read here in Ireland, in Dublin, I think it was in 1987, and he was one of about 20 writers taking part in an event in what was then the Royal Hospital in Kilmainham, and each of them was asked to read for no more than 5 minutes, and he was one of only three who stuck to that, and he read for about 2.5 minutes in Igbo with a 30-second translation into English, summary in English of what he'd read, and it was wonderful both to hear the language, but there was a real sense of mischief as well in him doing that, because he said, I'm donating the rest of my time to the other readers, and of course he got it right. But there is that mischief and humour as well running through his work.
There is. But just to step back a bit about proverbs. Proverbs are like a meta language, and I think that's probably why he could, you know, you can condense a huge amount of meaning in just a few lines, and I think that's why he could avoid verbosity. And yes, he is indeed a very mischievous character. You know, it shows through his works. And he uses that to sort of diffuse, you know, certain sensitive things he addresses. Not always successfully, yet, I might add, but, you know, it does go through his works, yes.
You're going to read a little from Things Fall Apart, a few extracts from it for us.
Yeah, sure. The first section here essentially is the bit that, explains the title exactly. And it goes, the white man is very clever. He came quietly with his religion. We were amused at his foolishness and allowed him to stay. Now he has won our brothers, and our clan can no longer act like one. He has put a knife on the things that held us together, and we have fallen apart. And when, as on that day, 9 of the greatest masked spirits in the clan came out together, it was a terrifying spectacle. Okonkwo's wives, and perhaps other women as well, might have noticed that the second Egugu had the springy walk of Okonkwo, and they might also have noticed that Okonkwo was not among the titled men and elders who sat behind the row of Egugu. But if they thought these things, they kept them to themselves. The Egugu with the springy walk was one of the dead fathers of the clan.
So here we have African life from its own perspective, named with authenticity, seen from the inside, and honoured, but not unquestioningly either. And I suppose this is an important thing about Achebe always, that he questioned, that he was critical, even of his own people and culture. Melanie, do we know why he chose to write in English when he had such an abiding love for his own language?
Well, he always had a love for English literature. That's, I think, why he became a writer as well. And he also said that he believed that novels, great novels, can change the world or can change the way people think. And he also thought that he wrote an essay on the use of the English language in African literature, and it's part of a big debate going on in African literature. And he said that he could reach a wider audience with English. And he also, I said earlier, and we talked about this idea of Africa being presented to us in a kind of a pre-colonial context, but I said that's an illusion because it's filtered through the English language and it's filtered through literary models like Yeats, for example, that he mentions, Mr. Johnson, Heart of Darkness. All these things are in there. So it's really a hybrid thing that he creates. It's a dialogue he creates with other writers. And I think at the root of it is really his love of English literature.
He was also a fearless critic, famously taking on Joseph Conrad,
yeah.
Who we described as a thoroughgoing racist for The Heart of Darkness. And his prose writing has this kind of fierce and but often again quite funny edge, where he does seem to he can be with the ferocity. There can be that kind of gentle humour that somehow dissipates it.
Yeah, and he also, I mean, when the lecture, it was first a lecture, this criticism of Joseph Conrad, and he caused a real stir in the lecture theatre among the academics who were listening to it at the time. And I think the way he reacted to it was also with humour. You know, it wasn't he didn't take it too badly. I think it's also a very important critique, because in many ways it anticipates things like, as Edward Said's, Orientalism. And in its conceptualization, in its analysis of how Africa is presented, represented by Europe. And it also anticipates things like Toni Morrison's Playing in the Dark, her critique of US-American literature and the Africanist presence, as she calls it. So it was an important statement. And I think even Conrad criticism nowadays, it's divided into before and after Achebe. So he's made a real impact on Conrad criticism as well.
And make novels again, like No Longer at Ease and Arrow of God, may not be as well known as his first book, but they're pretty fearless examinations of the impact of Christianity and colonialism on Africa, and quite remarkable work for a very young writer, as he was, as he still was then, and impossible always, I think, to separate politics from Achebe's life and work.
Yeah, it is. I mean, his work was pretty much political all through. He moved from the first book, Things Fall Apart, examining the Igbo culture. But he also moved up in the next book, No Longer at Ease, dealing with the Nigerian culture, the nascent Nigerian political landscape at the time. Essentially, the British colonialists had left and handed over power to Nigerians themselves. And it was quite a strange affair, because once the traditional institutions had been destroyed, as it were, we're now operating with the British structures and we're not used to them. And, you know, there was corruption nascently stepping into the place. And that was what he was exploring. And if you take that all the way to the book where he describes an unnamed African country, this was a prescient novel, because shortly after that, the first military coup took place in Nigeria. It became the start of a cycle of coups and counter coups that blighted the country for quite a long time.
I suppose, like many great writers, he seemed at times to almost have some sense of prophecy, you know, ability to see what, not just what may happen, but what will happen. And of course, then his involvement in Biafra during that terrible war as an ambassador of sorts for that brief-lived state is a huge part of his story and his life as well. And his, I think it was his last book, There Was a Country, about that time, is again a very moving account of that terrible, terrible war.
Yeah, I mean, Melanie described the stir he caused with his critique of Conrad, but that was on a global stage. There was a country has been a massive controversy around it in Nigeria, because it has essentially pitted Biafra, which is predominantly the Igbo tribe, against the Yoruba tribe. And the actions of one of the Yoruba nationalists, Chief Awolowo, during the war. There's been back and forth between Igbos and Yorubas, and unfortunately, that's one of the, like you said, Achebe doesn't write a rosy picture about our country. He writes about, or he talks about the structural weaknesses in the place, and one of them is tribalism. It is, rather than, you know, building a one united country, it is one side against the other, and unfortunately, that's pretty much the case still today.
How was he regarded in later years in Nigeria, we'll say among the ruling classes? I think he turned down an honour or two, didn't he, in the country?
He turned down two honours. The Commander of the Federal Republic of Nigeria, which I think is the second highest civilian honour in the country. And essentially it was because he could not abide with the significant decline of a country that had immense potential in 1960 when the British handed over. The problem with political class in Nigeria is that they look for opportunities to, if I would say, burnish their image. And Achebe definitely was one huge character on the world stage that would have done so. And I'm sure that was why the honor was given to him, and which I'm sure also he understood that and turned that down. So he was quite critical of the governments of the day in Nigeria.
But he still loved the country, didn't he?
Yes, he still loved the country. I mean, it's one of the dialectics Achebe and most of us in the diaspora have. We love the country, we love the land we are from. But the structures that govern it may not necessarily, lead to greatness. I mean, talking about Nelson Mandela, who recently passed away, he said the same thing about Nigeria. He is angry with Nigeria because Nigeria has failed to fulfill its manifest destiny. At independence, Nigeria was going places. You know, Nigeria was essentially the giant of Africa. And most Africans would probably tell you that Nigeria has held back the progress of the continent simply because of not fulfilling that manifest destiny.
And of course, Mandela, a great admirer of Achebe's work. Manley, for you, what's the enduring significance of Achebe's writing? Not just Things Fall Apart, but all of it. When you take the totality, the novels and the criticism, and he wrote poetry as well, of course, and a number of children's books. I mean, he had a pretty significant output.
Well, he is, though, mostly known for Things Fall Apart. If people don't know much of his other work, they will know Things Fall Apart, and that's always the book that's associated with his name. And that was so significant because it entered the canon of African literature almost immediately when it was published. And it's also the one book of his many works that continues to generate criticism, new ways of looking at the novel with each new generation of scholars. And in that sense, it's been compared to the work of William Shakespeare. And I think his other novels, as interesting as they are, I don't think have that kind of enduring appeal. And his criticism and his children's literature are also very interesting, I think, especially his criticism, I find. But also his children's literature. He wrote a children's book, I can't remember the title now, but somebody said that he wrote that during the Biafra War. It was one of the most significant things written during the Biafra War, one of his critics said. And I think the enduring appeal of Achebe's work will lie in that it's relatively accessible. You know, if you compare it to other works by African writers, it's I think because it was so accessible, it's made it such an enduring piece of work. And it's also, you know, it's a critique of the clash of civilizations, also of Europe meeting Africa. And his trilogy, like Things Fall Apart, and the two subsequent novels, they kind of epitomise that, and they've made it literary history, that part of history.
As we said earlier, the London-based Nigerian writer Chimamanda Adichie has said that Achebe's work gave her permission to write. Her novel Half of a Yellow Sun revisited the bitter territory of Biafra during the independence war of the late 1960s. Achebe, of course, had embraced the cause of Biafran independence, and this is some of what she had to say.
And now for my final Things Fall Apart story. On the campus of the University of Nigeria, where I grew up, the staff lived in houses owned by the university, and so a family would move out and another family would move in. And so the year that I turned 6, my family moved from a house on Mbanefo Street to another house on Margaret Cartwright Avenue, a bigger house with a staircase that at first terrified me. The family that had just moved out before we moved in was the Achebe family. I'm not sure I realized how significant a coincidence this was until I mentioned it some years ago to an editor before my first novel came out. You know, I said to her, it's really interesting that I grew up in a house that Chinua Achebe had previously lived in. And she stopped and stared at me and said, no, it's not interesting. It's the most important thing you've told me. And she said, it's more important than your university degree. It has to go. It has to go in the bio behind your book. So since then, the fact that I grew up in a house that Chinua Achebe previously lived in has become a central and possibly the most important part of my bio. And I'm so often asked what it was like to grow up in a house that Chinua Achebe had. I find myself remembering certain things, such as waking up at night to go to the bathroom and stopping near the staircase and hearing literary spirits whispering secrets in my ears. Secrets about plot and character and sentence structure. All right, well, I made that up. That is part of my imagination, of course, but what isn't part of my imagination and what I know for sure is that I would not be the writer I am if it wasn't for Chinua Achebe. And I feel deeply, deeply honored and grateful to have this opportunity to say a very public and heartfelt thank you to Chinua Achebe.
Chimamanda Adichie there with her memories of and tribute to Chinua Achebe. Things Fall Apart and many other works by Achebe are widely available. Thanks to Melanie Otto and Amika Chukwuru for helping us remember one of the great figures of modern African literature. And from literature to music, and this music from Nigeria. Welcome back to Arts Tonight. National anthem of South Africa, Nkosi Sikelele Afrika, there, a song, an anthem heard many times last month as Africa and the world mourned the death of Nelson Mandela. One of the striking aspects of the memorial events for Mandela was the role of song and music, a reminder of the significant part music had played in the anti-apartheid struggle and in many of the independence movements of Africa. As African and world music specialist Nigel Wood has been telling me.
Nelson Mandela himself was very aware of the power of music. I believe that music was very important to him when he was in prison, that there was a lot of singing. And certainly during the time he was in prison, the ANC became very aware that music was a powerful force. And so it proved, with certain, particularly the Free Nelson Mandela song. But Africans are in touch with this, and South Africa is no different from the rest of Africa.
And in fact, maybe even more so in a way, some of the roots of music seeming to be embedded very, very deeply in South Africa.
Very old, certainly. Some of the oldest historical records of music making come from that part of the world. And there's a nice little story I came across of Vasco da Gama arriving in 1490, whatever it was, and being greeted by a group of Khoi tribes people playing, five people playing reed flutes. I thought that was nice.
Lovely, lovely image. If we take the anthem of South Africa today, Nkosi Sikelele Afrika, and now something, I suppose, of a world anthem of hope and freedom, and I suppose the spirit of all Africa and of Mandela, indeed, seeming to be encapsulated in that. The song itself, which has become this anthem, has quite a fascinating history.
Yes, it was originally a religious song, a hymn, written by a guy who was part of the Methodist community in Johannesburg. And it was that was at the end of the 19th century. And it was a religious hymn that was then adopted for its sort of aspirational features, I suppose, by the ANC at a very early stage. One date I saw was 1925. They adopted it as their theme song or their, they're something to rally around, as it were. And then it went on and became more and more significant, I think, in the time. They're obviously very, very closely associated with Nelson himself. And there have been several different versions of it. It was interesting, actually. I had to sort of go searching for it through my record collection. I found, you know, I found several versions in the end. There's a lovely version from 1930, which was one of the first releases by the Gallo record label, which still exists, was formed around that time by a guy called Griffiths Mozzioloa, I think it is, from 1930, which is... lovely version. But,
and of course, in the song, several languages coming together quite deliberately, I suppose, uniting a place through language and including English.
Yes, I believe the final version of it as the South African anthem has five languages in it, but it also became the anthem for at one stage it was the anthem for five countries, I think, Namibia, Zimbabwe, that then initially, and they went on then to choose a different anthem afterwards, but also Tanzania and Zambia. The Tanzanian one is in Swahili, but it's become a pan-African song of, you know, independence and aspiration, and been very powerful.
And of course, the title meaning "God bless Africa."
God bless Africa, yeah.
Then there's that remarkable concert with McCabe and Paul Simon and Ladysmith, Black Mambazo, performing in Cosi Scaletti. But it was a reminder too, now looking back at all of that, that musicians really suffered, many of them suffered deeply in the struggle against apartheid. I think Mary McCabe was in exile for 30 years, so people really paid the price of their beliefs.
Yes, they did, yes. That's, you know, and music was charged with that sort of, that political significance of resisting the apartheid regime. And so jazz too. South Africa is unique, I think, in African music in that it has a very specific jazz genre in its musical panoply. And the jazz musicians, they pushed against apartheid all the time, you know, with sort of multiracial groups, in the end, there was a group called the Blue Notes, which had some, you know, very prominent jazz musicians in it, and they eventually left in 1964, I think. Hugh Masekela, exiled for 30 years, Miriam Makeba the same, you know, travelled around in various places. She lived in Guinea for a while. It was very hard. The regime was extraordinarily repressive towards any hint of pushing for freedom, as the musicians so naturally did, really. It's amazing to think of McCabe coming back to South Africa in 1960 from her mother's funeral and being refused admission to her own country. I mean, a reminder of the power of oppression. And then, I suppose, a reminder on the other hand of the wonderful power of music as a liberator, that moment with Paul Simon, and a controversial moment in 1986 with his Graceland album, and him being perceived by some people to have broken the boycott of South Africa, the cultural boycott, by going to play with Ladysmith, Black Mambazo, and to make this extraordinary album that
really became a focus of joy.
Mm. Yes, Ladysmith Black Mambazo had been very popular in the 70s. They were beginning to lose the thread of, you know, the contemporary, what was happening in music in South Africa. And, you know, people were less keen and moved on to other things in the 80s. But when Paul Simon came across them, he obviously recognised that there was something very special here, which there was. And I wonder why he was not more aware of the controversy that would, you know, arise from his association with them. But I would feel sort of magnanimous about it. I feel that he was doing it probably for the right reasons. He really was doing it for musical reasons. He recognised that it's such a special thing that they had. And I think it was, in the end, he was justified. I he was taken to task for a long time, but I think in the end was forgiven, and quite rightly. I mean, it was a very special moment in bringing, I mean, world music generally to the international stage. I mean, and they've never been off it. I mean, they're still enormously popular, and they are a kind of, they're a genre of their own, really, and continue to be so.
Yeah, because the music, songs like Diamonds and the Soles of Her Shoes, it remains so fresh and so vivid and so full of joy. From Paul Simon's Graceland album there from 1986, hard to believe. Peter Gabriel's song, Biko, from I think around 1980 or a little earlier, was also this significant moment of, I suppose, music remembering and making a political statement.
Yes.
And used in the film Cry Freedom. So this song and film remembering Steve Biko, great campaigner against apartheid.
Mm, yes, he was. And died in police custody. I think that was very significant. And I think in a way, you know, you could see that as the start of a protest movement in relation to South Africa that then, you know, produced some years later the Free Nelson Mandela song.
The Specials and Free Nelson Mandela there. Another notable figure in South African music, and one we don't hear about so much, is Johnny Clegg, a white musician who opposed apartheid, and again, good to remember that many did. And of course, there is this famous image of Mandela dancing to his music after he was released from jail.
Yes. Yes, there are lovely, there's a few lovely sequences of Mandela dancing, which is...
he was a good dancer.
He was a good dancer. He had the spirit of it, definitely. And he showed other statesmen a thing or two, I think. Johnny Clegg was, he was a powerful force. I can't say that I've listened to a lot of his music, but he absolutely kept to his line. He refused to recognise the colour bar, as it were, and he absolutely stuck to it, and, you know, fair play to him. He was a pioneer in that way, in his own right. Yeah.
Let's hear a little of Johnny Clegg with this track, Asim Bonanga. Nigel Wood, the history of music and South Africa is, I suppose, just one part of a vast story of music and political expression on the whole of the African continent. Congolese music, a significant part of that. And this remarkable figure, Le Grand Calais, whose legacy and influence was just recently marked with a fine new album.
Yes, that's right. Well, it's the wonderful UK-based label Stearns, who have been producing or collecting African music for many, many years now, put out a compilation of Le Grand Calais' output, a 2-CD set with a wonderful book with it, which sort of details all the history. What was going on politically at the time through independence and so on, because this is music that was produced in the late 50s, the 60s and the 70s. He died in 1983, but he hadn't actually recorded for some years before that. They've finally given him the recognition he deserves, because he really came first in terms of Congolese music. Franco is probably better known, and there have been Stearns have put out two lovely compilations of his work, but Le Grand Calais was first, and he was a major influence on Franco. And Tabule Rochereau, who died recently, was also part of a member of Le Grand Calais' band.
The Independence Cha-Cha there from the Congo. The music now, this huge mosaic of new music in that vast country. I think rap and this new form of house techno really big as well.
Yes, I mean, elements of the roots are still there, you know, the style. I mean, South African music is distinct from the rest of the continent. I mean, it has connections, of course, with Zimbabwe and so on across the border, but it has a swing that I think of as something a little bit different. And the reason for that, I imagine, is to do with the enormous influx of American miners, who prospectors who came in the late 1800s for gold and diamonds and so on. And there was a massive influx of Americans at that time, and they brought instruments. And I think you can see, you know, most of the styles of music up until maybe the more modern era that you're talking about, certainly perhaps is still there, there's a swing about it, which is, you know, a jazz influence. So you have that sort of jazz swing thing, and then you have voices, you know, voices that are just so important in South African music.
Thanks to Nigel Wood for that small journey in the vast landscapes of African music and protest. Next week, the painter Robert Armstrong on his new work and 30 years of Temple Bar studio and galleries. Join us on Monday at 10. Till then, from all of us, good night.
Arts Tonight, presented by Vincent Woods, was produced by Aileen O'Mara for Digital Audio Productions.